Good morning. I'm going to start today with a reading from Max Lucado's book, In the Eye of the Storm. He placed one scoop of clay upon another until a form lay lifeless on the ground. All were silent as the Creator reached in himself and removed something yet unseen. It's called choice, the seed of choice. Creation stood in silence and gazed upon the lifeless form. An angel spoke, "But what if he chooses not to love?" The Creator finished. "Come, I will show you." Unbound by today, God and the angel walked into the realm of tomorrow. The angel gasped at what he saw. Spontaneous love, voluntary devotion. Never had he seen anything like these. The angel stood speechless as they passed through centuries of repugnance. Never had he seen such filth, rotten hearts, ruptured promises, forgotten loyalties. The Creator walked on in time, further and further into the future, until he stood by a tree that would be fashioned into a cradle. Even then, he could smell the hay that would surround him. Wouldn't it be easier to not plant the seed? Wouldn't it be easier to not give the choice? It would, the Creator spoke slowly, but to remove the choice is to remove the love. They stepped into the garden again. The Maker looked earnestly at the clay creation. A monsoon of love swelled up within him. He had died for the creation before he had made him. God's form bent over the sculptured face and breathed. Dust stirred on the lips of the new one. The chest rose, cracking the red mud. The cheeks fleshened, a finger moved, and an eye opened. But more incredible than the moving of the flesh was the stirring of the spirit. Those who could see the unseen gasped. Perhaps it was the wind who said it first. Perhaps what the star saw that moment is what has made it blink ever since. Maybe it was left to an angel to whisper it. It looks like, it appears so much like him. The angel wasn't speaking of the face, the features, or the body. He was looking inside at the soul. "It's eternal," gasped another. Within the man, God had placed a divine seed, a seed of his self. The God of might had created earth's mightiest. The Creator had created not a creature, but another creator. And the one who had chosen to love had created one who could love in return. Genesis 2, as a second creation story or a second part to the creation story, focuses on the creation of humans, the pinnacle of the creation account in chapter 1. In Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27, we read that God created people in God's image. And in chapter 2, we're given details of how God formed or created man and later woman. The word used in chapter 2, verse 7, which we translate as formed, is a Hebrew verb that was used commonly in talking about the work of a potter, in fashioning vessels from lumps of clay. It is this verb that is also in Jeremiah 18, which reads, "This is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Go down to the potter's house, and there I will give you my message. So I went down to the potter's house, and I saw him working at the wheel, but the pot he was shaping from the clay was marred in his hands. So the potter formed it into another pot, shaping it as seemed best to him. Then the word of the Lord came to me, 'O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter does?' declares the Lord. Like clay in the hand of the potter, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel." And in Isaiah chapter 29, verse 16, God says, "You turn things upside down as if the potter were thought to be like the clay. Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, 'He did not make me'? Can the pot say of the potter, he knows nothing? So this first man was fashioned as a potter would fashion a pot or a vessel from a lump of clay or of earth in Genesis 2, verse 7. And yet we read in Genesis 1, 27 that humans were created in God's image or likeness. So we have had from the very beginning a dual nature. We're made from the earth, and yet we're made in God's image. This means that we are intimately related to and connected to the rest of creation. Our bodies are composed of many of the same chemical elements that we can find in the earth. We have a physical, material affinity with the animals and with the earth. We're all made essentially of the same stuff. And yet, we are also very different from everything else in creation. And Genesis tells us why. Humans are the only part of creation created in God's image. And what that means is very multi-layered and can mean very different things. In Max Lucado's reading that I just read, he talks about it being the seed of choice, something eternal that's inside us. The Interpreter's Bible commentary talks about it as curiosity, as the distinctive characteristic of humans, the desire to know and to learn. In his book, The God of Creation, Theodore Epp notes three levels to created life. First is vegetation, which has unconscious life. It's basically just a body that grows. The next level is animals with conscious life. Animals have a more developed life than plants. They relate to each other and the world in a variety of ways. But humans have one more level. We have God-conscious life. We have life on a spiritual level. God's breath of life imparted some of God's personality into humankind. And so we are also related in a very personal and unique way to our Creator. And we are related to the rest of creation in a material and also a vocational way. In Genesis chapters 1 and 2, we read not only about humankind's creation, but also about humankind's vocation, our purpose. This next part I take a lot from the resources from Jennifer Haltman Schrock, who wrote these resources for the summer. As in our creation, there are two sides as well to our vocation. Genesis 1 focuses on humanity's dominion over all living things. And the word dominion implies power, authority, and responsibility. And it's related to us being created in the image of God. In the ancient Near East, kings were understood to be the image of their nation's God. So to be made in the image of God, or to be in the image of God, is almost a political statement. Genesis 1, then, in a sense, states that all of us represent God on earth. As the image of God, we are bound to the will of God, to God's goals and values, which, if we read Genesis 1, are all about bringing order out of chaos and about enjoying creation. The Old Testament also often uses the terms or images of shepherd and king together. So our role in having dominion isn't just about ruling, but also about caretaking and protecting. We have a royal role, a kingly purpose on earth, but it is not about absolute power. And then we read in Genesis 2 that we are to serve creation. The verbs that we often translate to till or to keep the garden are not actually agricultural terms. Biblical scholar Ellen Davis suggests that they are actually worship terms, better translated as to serve and to observe. So God put this man in the garden to serve it and to observe it or to watch it, to keep it as we keep the commandments or as God keeps us, as we read in Psalm 121. What would it look like if we lived as servants of the earth? How would we go about serving creation? Gordon MacDonald writes this: accepting my role as a servant to properly handle the assets of the prince brings a real-world meaning to my faith. It causes me to think ecologically about my responsibility for Christ's environment. It is enjoyable to consider what a greater world under the reign of the prince would be like, where all things, humanity, living things, the stuff of creation, might exist as they were meant to be in the creative mind of God. And such a dream is not idle fantasy. It answers to something I believe is hidden within each one of us, a memory deep in our spiritual genes that knew of a time when God came down and walked with man and everything was good. And the dream also answers a hope deep within us. Some have called it a healthy homesickness, that one day all things will be restored to their original creative intent by the hand of God. Believing that this is exactly what will happen when the prince returns in glorious triumph, the servant of the kingdom makes a little history each day by claiming hunks of a spoiled creation and establishing Christ's presence in it. It cannot be done permanently. Picked up streets get dirty again, and work done well the first time has to be done over again. But it can be done with a conviction that it makes a statement and brings Christ to places where he might otherwise never have been known. What if serving the earth means that we try to do God's will on earth, that we try to bring order into the chaos, to see the good in creation, to protect and to defend it, maybe to love it? What would that look like in our everyday lives? I'm not sure. I'll leave that with you. What would it look like if we kept creation as we keep the commandments, or as God keeps us? What does that even mean? When we say we keep the commandments, we mean that we live by them, we honor them, we obey them, we keep them in our minds and hearts. When we say that God keeps us, we mean that God watches, protects, holds, embraces, that God remembers us. So maybe to keep the garden means that we honor it, that we watch over it, that we think about and remember it, and that we love it. Humankind's creation was unique and special. God used his own hands to fashion us and his own breath to enliven us. Our vocation and our purpose is also unique and special. As representatives of God, intimately connected to both the Creator and the creation, we have been given the role of servant shepherds, of protectors. We are to love and serve and keep the world as God loves, serves, and keeps the world. And this has consequences for all of us as a human race, as well as individuals. We have power and authority, but we also have limits and responsibilities. One of the special jobs, in fact, the first specific task we read about in the Bible that Adam was given in the garden, was that of naming the animals. In ancient times, to name something or someone implied that you had dominion over it or ownership of it. For instance, in the New Testament, we read the fact that Joseph named this boy Jesus implied that he had legally adopted Mary's son just by the act of naming him. Of course, Jesus was actually named by God, so that implies something too. There was, and there still is, I think, power in names. A thing's name is that by which that object is summoned into the field of thought, that which is necessary for that object's full existence. In naming the animals, Adam was determining what each animal should be like and how they should behave. Now, naming doesn't quite have that same power for us, but it is still of importance. We all know of babies whose names we kind of cringe at and whose parents we secretly chastise for the suffering that child will receive. as they grow, even as we smile and say, how unique that name is, or some such phrase. Most of us take care when we choose the names of our children. Maybe we choose them from our family heritage, or from biblical stories. Or maybe we take care not to choose certain names because of what they sound like, or bad connotations with that name, or maybe because they are family names. We also talk about how naming our feelings and naming a situation can bring truth and a sense of control. We also judge people by their names, whether they have the right names or not. Knowing someone's name is an important step in getting to know them. And having someone remember your name can be quite special. Jennifer Schrock talks about Adam's naming of the animal as paralleling or echoing God's naming in Genesis 1, as God separated and differentiated and called into being the light and the darkness, the land and the sea. She writes, "Naming is a celebration of diversity, a careful sorting out of one species from another." Robin Wall Kimmerer, a Native American biologist who has spent her life teaching students the names of obscure mosses, explains that in her culture, it is a sign of respect to call a being by its name and a sign of disrespect to ignore it. Words and names are the way we humans build relationship. Something similar is going on here. God brings each animal to the man, and the man approaches each with the question, what kind of relationship can I have with this creature? How can we be together in this new world? Connections form. Each species is now known and dignified with a name. One of the main experiences that we have with naming is as parents. So perhaps we can add to our role of shepherd servants the role of parent to creation. Yes, we have authority, but we also have huge responsibility, and we have a special relationship with creation, more than we are just masters over it. Genesis 1 and 2 have a lot to say about the Creator and the creation and the relationships between all of us. Humanity is shown as both majestic and earthy, both spiritual and physical. This dual nature connects us to God, our eternal Creator and Lord, just as it connects us to creation, the material and physical space and time that we live in here on earth. Yes, we are fundamentally different from the rest of creation, but we are also fundamentally different from the Creator. Yes, we have been given tasks and a purpose, a role as steward and servant of this earth, but it is God's purpose, not ours, that we should be working toward and working out. Yes, we have been given the breath of God, an eternal spark, the opportunity to choose and to question. But ultimately, we are creatures who need to submit to our Creator in order to truly find ourselves. Yes, we are created in the image of God, but we were formed from lumps of dirt. We are in God's image, but God is wholly other. To close, I want to read a section from A.W. Tozer in The Root of Righteousness. God is always first, and God will surely be last. To say this is not to draw God downward into the stream of time and involve him in the flux and flow of the world. He stands above his own creation and outside of time, but for the convenience of his creatures, who are children of time, he makes free use of time words when referring to himself. So he says that he is the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the ending, the first and the last. Humans in the plan of God have been granted considerable say, but never are we permitted to offer the first word nor the last. That is the prerogative of the deity, and one which he will never surrender to his creatures. This knowledge should humble us and encourage us too, It should humble us when we remember how frail we are, how utterly dependent on God. And it should encourage us to know that when everything else has passed, we may still have God no less surely than before. Amen.
Thank you, Janet, for sharing. And for the next part, Ray, would you please come up and sing Obey My Voice?